Good morning, my friends. That's kind of an exciting little way to start out our lesson, isn't it? This is a kind of a wild story that we're going to have this morning. But about 2 months ago, actually almost exactly 2 months ago, we started the second part of Acts, and I spoke on and gave a kind of overview of the second part and said it read like a novel and make a good movie. You remember that? A lot of good scenes. And so as we've moved through a lot of those things, we've seen such a variety of excitement and hardship, from miraculous healings to beatings and stoning almost to death, from wonderful teaching and many turning to Christ, to much rejection, mocking, having to flee cities because of opposition, from some sharp disagreements among believers to some wonderful oneness among the believers, from home churches being established to being beaten and thrown in jail because of casting out a demon. How's that for a movie? Pretty good variety, isn't it? We've seen all that. And so due to time, we can't go through the whole book of Acts, but we've been doing little vignettes or parts of Acts, and each one has its own topic that have been great to think about. But I don't want us to lose the whole of Acts because it's such an exciting story. So I'm going to do just a quick fill in the blanks where I think we've maybe been missing some of the story, and it'll help this story today make more sense. I think one of the best movie scenes of all that would be when Paul and Silas cast out a demon, then got put in prison and were beaten, and then there was a huge earthquake and they were freed, and they kept all the people in jail, and the jailer and his whole family became believers. And Laura spoke on that 2 weeks ago, and that was really a great story. So I'm going to put a map up. It's not necessarily the journeys of Paul, but I want you to be looking at this map because I want us to see the amount of places Paul went and how far it was. And he didn't have airplanes and great boats. He had sailboats and walking. And he actually was amazing. And just from Laura's talk till the one that we come to today, Paul went through many, many miles. So if you can see up near the top is Philippi, way up high. That's where they were, and then Paul and Silas took off and went down to Thessalonica. And Paul continued to preach there. And as usual, guess what happened? He got opposition. The Jews were jealous, and they formed a mob. And it said that they rounded up some bad characters. I thought that was funny, and started a riot. And it reminded me of a lot of the protests and stuff we see today. I think they do round them up to cause trouble. So it's very relevant to our society today. They couldn't find Paul and Silas to get them in trouble, so they went to a man's house named Jason, and they dragged him before the city council. And they claimed, "These men have caused trouble all over the whole world." I love that. They knew that Paul and Silas had a huge impact. One thing about Paul, if you either really liked him and he brought good things, or people really hated him, and there was no neutral response. And this is a really silly illustration, but I was thinking of the food beets. Either people love beets or they hate beets. Nobody is neutral about beets. So my son gives silly things like that, so you remember that. So Paul, he makes an impact wherever he goes. So when they dragged Jason out, he's because he had housed Paul and Silas. And I thought, you know, in our world today, we can get in trouble just by associating with strong Christians. Not so much in America yet, but in other countries, it's dangerous to be associated. So the believers sent Paul and Silas away to protect them, and they fled at night to Berea. And it's just down a little bit from Thessalonica. And I love what it says about the Berean Jews. It says they were of more noble character than those in Thessalonica, and they received the message with great eagerness and examined the scriptures every day to see if what Paul said was true. Isn't that neat? To really study scripture, and I know just in the study we're in, there's a preacher that's well known in America, and we decided to analyze his sermons because some people thought it was a prosperity gospel and some didn't. And so we took sentences out of his sermon and tried to determine what that would be. So we were examining it to see if it was scriptural or not. So that's a good attitude, and we should do that. Well, that was too good to last, to have these wonderful people studying Paul. So men came from Thessalonica to start causing trouble again, and Christina mentioned that last week. So they got Paul off to the coast, and he went by himself to Athens. And so that's, where is Athens? It's a ways. I can't see it right now. So he went alone, and he was going to wait there for Silas and Timothy, but he couldn't keep quiet. He couldn't just go rest. He saw something to an unknown God, and so we preached a sermon on that. And Christina did such a great job last week of talking about how Paul related to their culture. And I loved what she said. Paul always had the same message, but he did it in a different context depending on who he was talking to. He was a master at that, and that's something we can learn. So between last week's time Paul in Athens till this week's, there's a lot that went on. Paul then went to Corinth, and it seems like he went alone. And he met a married couple there named Priscilla and Aquila. Many of you have heard of them. There's not many married couples that are mentioned in the Bible that do ministry together. And they were tent makers. And Paul also was a tent maker. And so he worked with them and then preached in the synagogue on the Sabbath. When Silas and Timothy came, Paul then devoted himself entirely to preaching. And of course, persecution arose, and the Jews opposed Paul, and Paul at that point was really frustrated, and he made a strong statement. He said, from now on, I will go to the Gentiles. And that was really, remember, his main calling. He did keep teaching Jews, but he would not just go to the synagogues. Now he would go to more neutral Gentile places. Soon after that, when he was so frustrated, I thought God did a wonderful thing. He came to him in a vision, and he said, don't be afraid, Paul. Keep on speaking. Do not be silent, for I am with you, and no one is going to attack you and harm you. And I thought, wasn't that a neat thing for Paul? Finally, he's maybe can get a little break, and so he could keep teaching, which he did. And then he said, I want you to stay here because I have many people in this city. And I love that statement. So Paul ended up staying in Corinth for 1.5 years and had a respite from traveling. And then he's off again. He leaves Corinth and takes Priscilla and Aquila, and they sail across from Corinth over to Ephesus. So again, he's on a sailboat, and we don't hear much about that. And he left them in Ephesus, so they're probably working with the Christians there. And he went to Caesarea, which is a long, all the way there, it goes all the way down near Jerusalem, actually, Caesarea, and then there's Jerusalem, and then up to Antioch. And he went and visited the church in Jerusalem and greeted them, and then went back to Antioch. And that, if you remember, is where Paul started his first missionary journey. A lot of Christians there, and I thought he probably got lots of needed rest and support for a while. And it reminded me of, I was on campus crusade staff for a couple of years, and we'd be out ministering all year, and then we'd come together at our summer conference in Arrowhead Springs. And it was so nice. You were just around all Christians who loved you and supported you, and you kind of got filled up to go back out. And I think that's what happened to Paul. So then after a little time there, he sets off on his third missionary journey. And it seems like, again, he was kind of alone. Maybe there were some traveling companions. But he went through the area just all in that kind of orangey pink and went back to the churches that he had established on his first and second missionary journeys. And it said he went to strengthen all the believers. And again, another good model for us. When you're involved with new believers, don't just leave them. We need to keep encouraging and spending time with them. And Paul did it. And it wasn't easy for him to go all that way to do that. Meanwhile, while he's on the road back in Ephesus, Priscilla and Aquila are there, and they met a man named Apollos. And Apollos knew the scriptures well, and he spoke very boldly. But he only knew about John the Baptist's baptism of water. He didn't really know a lot of the teachings on the Holy Spirit. And so when Priscilla and Aquila heard him, I love this part. They invited him to their home and explained to him the way of God more clearly. It was so sweet. They didn't call him out on it or say, you're wrong. They took him into their home and taught him. And Apollos became an amazing, strong speaker. He ends up going back to Corinth, and it said about him, he vigorously refuted his Jewish opponents in public debate, proving from the scriptures that Jesus was the Messiah. We don't know who wrote Hebrews, but a possible person is Apollos. He's one that may be considered, but quite a man that we don't know very much about. So Paul's been traveling on land, and now he arrives at Ephesus, where our story takes place today. He taught boldly in the synagogue for 3 months, and surprise, surprise, what happened? More persecution. The Jews became obstinate, and they maligned Paul. So he left the synagogue and lectured daily in a place called the Lecture Hall of Tyrannus, and taught there for 2 years. So he's staying places. He stayed in Corinth a year and a half, but now he's staying in Ephesus for 2 years. And at that time it said that all the Jews and Greeks who lived in the province of Asia heard the word of the Lord. Isn't that amazing? He reminds me of Billy Graham just a little bit. So we've been talking about him. The whole world heard from Billy Graham. And Paul, the whole world knowing then knew about Jesus from Paul. And at this time, God did extraordinary miracles through Paul. I haven't read that before. He probably was doing it all the time. But if Paul touched handkerchiefs or aprons, had touched his body, they can take them out and put them on the sick people and they would be healed. So it was very miraculous at that time. And so I would say, and they even demons would leave the people if they were touched by Paul's handkerchief. So this was probably a really high point where it was pretty calm for Paul. And about his teaching, I read in a commentary by John Stott. He said, assuming that Paul kept one day in seven for the day of rest, the Sabbath rest. So he taught 6 days because he taught continually. And in that time, the way they taught for about 5 hours a day, 6 days a week. And he did it for 2 years. So I thought this was interesting. That would make 3,120 hours of gospel teaching and persuasion. 3,120. No wonder people around them knew about Jesus and were so impacted by Paul's teaching. I love that. Can you imagine? I had a hard time just working on this talk. I don't know if Paul did it. God had certainly gifted him. So this is a fun part of the story. About this time, so Paul was really well known in teaching, and there were some men that were trying to cast out demons in Jesus' name, but they didn't really know Jesus. And the Spirit answered them, Paul I know, Jesus I know, but who are you? And they really didn't have the Spirit in them. So the demon in the man, through the man, ended up beating up all these people that had been doing that. And so this, of course, was known all over. It was a very interesting story, and they were afraid. And then it says the name of Jesus was held in high honor. So actually, people respected Jesus from seeing that. From this time and hearing all of Paul's preaching and his friends, they started to confess their sins. They saw where they were wrong. And many who had practiced sorcery began to burn their books. And they were worth thousands and thousands of, I don't know what, not dollars, but whatever they had. So they were, they gave up a lot of their sins, and the word of the Lord spread widely and with great power. So, of course, he got a few years of relief, but then what happened? Satan doesn't like what was going on. The world doesn't like what's going on. So Paul, after 2 years, decides to leave. But just before he left, there arose a great disturbance. And it was about the, quote, way. Did you read that? The way, which really is another word for Christianity or Christians. And that's the beginning of our story that we come to today that you read. And so I hope at least that helps put it in context. So Paul has traveled a lot since Christina spoke last week and when he was in Athens. We've only had a week, but Paul's been gone for months. So Paul actually isn't the main character in this story, although he helped cause a lot of it. But it's more about the movement that has started of the way of Christianity. It's the Christians who caused the stir. And so this passage, I think, can be divided that we read today into three parts. The first is about a silversmith named Demetrius and his work and his religion of the goddess Artemis. Secondly, his stirring up the people and their mob mentality. And thirdly, the town clerk and his very wise response. Demetrius had a lucrative trade making silver shrines to sell to honor the goddess of Artemis. She is the Ephesians' major goddess, the goddess of fertility. Also, she was known as Diana from the Romans. They called her that, and that's what I heard about her in the first place. But Artemis is what the Greeks called her. And as it said in our workbook, that It said that in the past, a meteorite had smashed into the surface of the earth near Ephesus, and the local people had regarded it as a gift from heaven, a statue of the goddess herself. We love these fork lores. That's a picture of Artemis or Diana. That's who they worshipped. The whole city, the whole area worshipped her. And she has all those, like, orbs or whatever you want to call them around her stomach. And many people think those were breasts, a lot of breasts, because she's a goddess of fertility. But in the commentary I read, it said that is the common assumption, but they really think that it represents testicles of a bull or gourds. So I want to go, Jesus or Artemis? Who would you pick? She's worshipped not just in Ephesus, but all over. And when we went to Israel one year, we were in Jordan, and there's a city called Jerash. Some of you may have been there. It has probably some of the best architectural digs that are still standing. And there was one to the goddess of Diana there. And so I had a picture of me. I laid up on the altar, but it didn't turn out very good, so I'm not showing it. But the major site is in Ephesus. And they built a temple to her. This is a model. Obviously, it didn't look like this today. It is an amazing structure. It's four times the size of the Parthenon. The pillars are 60 feet high. It's about 425 feet by 225 feet, much larger than a football field. So on that day, can you imagine? It's the largest building in the Greek world, and at that time, it was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. It was destroyed several times and rebuilt, and today, that's all that's left. There's a lot of other ruins in Ephesus, a lot better, but I thought, you know, false gods don't last forever. Jesus is alive. They are not. So Demetrius is worried by three things when the Christian way is coming. He's worried about profit, about his money. He's worried about that way, turning away people from their gods. And he's worried about the fall of Artemis herself. She is this great goddess. And what would happen if all of a sudden she wasn't lifted up? And so he has economic, cultural, and religious issues. And we'll get to that in our day too soon. So Demetrius was afraid of losing his wealth and got others to be afraid too. They were worried about losing their gods because Paul teaches that gods made with human hands are not gods at all. And of course, that's all that Demetrius was selling. And the most ominous is Artemis herself. What if something happened to her and she's destroyed? Her then temple might be thought of as nothing, and this is the main god that all these people are worshiping. So I think with that, it would be easy to get a crowd rioting. And they grabbed Paul's traveling companions, not Paul. He was hidden. And they all rushed to the theater together, yelling, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians." And Paul wasn't allowed to go. For once, he was protected. His disciples protected him, and some civil leaders protected him who admired him and respected him. The theater is a really large one with the capacity to hold 24,000 people in its day. And this is the ruins that are still left from that amazing theater. And they had huge civic assemblies there where they would decide things, but they didn't usually have riots. And this was a riot with confusion, yelling, chaos. And it says some of them didn't even know why they were there. Haven't we seen that too in our riots of today? They put a man named Alexander forward. And I was trying to figure out, who is this Alexander? He was a Jew. And as I read, we don't know who he was or why he was chosen or really what he was expected to say. Probably some kind of defense. And they think that maybe the Jews wanted to differentiate themselves from the Christians because it was the Christians that were getting persecuted. But the Jews weren't liked either. And they were also known as being opposed to idolatry. So whatever, he wasn't listened to. And for 2 hours, they shouted him down with, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians." And it reminded me of like putting our hands on our ears and just going, la, 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 la. They didn't want to listen. They didn't want the truth. And in one commentary, it said the only thing heathenism can do against Paul is to shout itself hoarse. That was great. So I think we come now to the hero of the story. A wise and calm, rational man, the city clerk. and I think he should have been given a name. He was amazing. He was able to quiet the crowd, and he presented 4 points rationally to them that made sense. First, he says, the whole world knows that Artemis is the guardian of Artemis Temple. No one can deny that, so she's not in any danger. Then he said, these men, who were Gaius and Aristarchus, who was Paul's companions, are not guilty of robbing the temple or reviling the goddess. In other words, they're not talking bad of her. They're just teaching about a new god, Jesus. And that reminded me of when we try to, you've probably all heard this, but when we want to see counterfeit money, or you want to see if it's counterfeit, you don't spend a lot of time looking at the counterfeit. You spend time looking at the real money. And I think in this case, when we're trying to engage our culture, we don't want to talk so much about all the bad things that we think they're doing, but we need to present our biblical view more and concentrate on that. The third point he made is, if Demetrius and the others have a grievance, they should bring it to the courts. Rome was very organized, and they had a system for doing that. And fourthly, he said the citizens themselves are in danger of being charged with civil disobedience. And I thought he's such a great example of knowing how to engage his culture. He knew their god, he knew the Roman law, how it operated, and he knew the consequences of rioting. After his talk, it just said he dismissed the assembly. I love that. He stopped what could have been a pretty wild event with people rioting and getting hurt. And I thought, wouldn't it be nice to have that calm and rational approach as we engage our culture? Because I think today we are basically in a culture war, a civil war of values in our country, now more than ever, as we all know. And we need to know what we believe and how to articulate it. And I'm going to share some ideas of where I think the battles are. I wish I could give you all the answers of how to engage. I don't know how to. I would like to learn. And I'm hoping that today, as we hear these, we will all want to learn a better way to articulate our biblical viewpoint to people. There's so many attacks on Christianity, and they're just getting worse and worse. And many of the attacks against our values, you can find the answers in Genesis 1 to 3. It's really interesting. To name a few, God created the heavens and the earth. That's almost the first verse in the Bible. Evolution is taught as a fact in almost all schools today, with no thought to creationism. Can we articulate why we believe that there's a creator and he created our earth? God created man, the apex of creation, and he made us in his image. It says he created them male and female, not about 6 or 7 genders, male and female. That is really being challenged today. It doesn't say that you can be whatever you feel like today. And there's no verse on that one. A man is to leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. We believe that a marriage is between one man and one woman. This, again, is totally challenged today. And there was a Proposition 8, I believe, totally clear on this, but it was to either to defend or go against a man and a woman, a marriage being between a man and a woman. And we happened to be driving down the road by the Mormon church, and there were all these people out picketing against the Mormons because they believed that the marriage should be between a man and a woman. And it was ugly. And they weren't nice at all, and I thought, I don't want to stop and talk to them, but it wasn't a pretty approach. And we found out that some of our friends that gave a lot to help support this proposition that would say marriage is between one man and a woman, and all of them got audited strongly, and maybe some of you did, for supporting that proposition. That's persecution. It says God created man in his own image. He blessed them and said, be fruitful and multiply. Fill the earth and rule over the animals and take care of them. But we are not the same as the animals. And yet, I think in our society we're beginning to twist that. We kill millions of babies through abortion, and yet animal rights get stronger and stronger. I saw a billboard the other day that said dogs are people too. I like dogs, but they're not people. My one experience of engaging the culture on this issue happened a few years ago, and I saw people picketing out in front of honey-baked hams on the Coast Highway. Save the pigs. And so before I could really think and not get scared, I just decided to go up and talk to them. So I went up. I was very polite and picked out one woman and I said, may I just ask you a question? And she got all excited because she thought I'd be interested. And I said, are you pro-choice? I used the right word. And she goes, what does that have to do with anything? That doesn't matter. And I said, no, I just want to know if you are. And she said, yes. So I said, don't you think it's ironic that you're out here picketing for saving the pigs and yet you will let little babies be killed? She was not happy with me. But I said it kindly and nicely, and I just said at the end, I hope that this will give you something to think about. That was my big, brave engagement of the culture. I think, as I was thinking of all the issues, and there's so many more, and we don't have time to talk about them today, but I think abortion relates to this story today with Demetrius, maybe the most closely. Demetrius was worried about losing a lot of money if his business was wrecked. So he would be hurt economically. Planned Parenthood makes millions. My husband was looking up statistics for me. It's amazing how much money they make from mostly abortions, although they want to say they're helping women. So if Christians started confronting them, they would lose money. They would lose culturally because they want to have the woman's right to choose. That would hurt them. And spiritually, if they really started listening to us, maybe their conscience would be pricked a little bit. So this picture, I think, shows in a nice way the war that's going on. There's really two sides. And I love this. At church, the stork bus came. Have you heard of that? I just have this in it. They go in front of abortion clinics, and they have this beautiful bus, and they have it where they can give girls an ultrasound. And it says 4 out of 5 women who board a stork bus choose life. And I know there's so many organizations that help that. 84% of post-abortive women thought abortion was their only option. So there's ways to start helping instead of fighting. Even I've had 2 young gals stay with me that were pregnant that one might have aborted, and I thought, well, I really believe she shouldn't. I should have her. So there's Christian responses. And I've asked Yvette, who is our helper here so much at Grace, but she's a pediatrician, and she's going to come share just a couple issues that she's facing if she went back into practice.
Hi, ladies. You all know me, Yvette, and what some of you may not know is I'm a pediatrician, and for 17 years, I practiced in the inner city up in Long Beach. My population was about 90% Hispanic because Spanish is my first language, and I got to see a lot of heartbreaking situations. But during that time, I really felt like God has me here because he wants me to speak hope to these kids and to these parents. Unfortunately, a few years ago, our clinic got taken over, and the entire staff was basically let go. So at that point, I thought, I have 3 teenagers at home. I'm just going to hang out and, you know, do life with them. In the process of, you know, thinking about whether I want to go back or not, I have been weighed down because so many issues have come up that I don't know if I could return to medicine at this point and really give people the hope that they so need. We get mandates, basically, from the American Academy of Pediatrics periodically, and they will tell us we need to be trained in certain things or we need to expound certain principles. And unfortunately, literally over the last year and a half, they've all been politically correct, things that just are heartbreaking. They don't give our kids hope. They actually lead them to areas that we don't want them to go. For example, medical marijuana. We were given a whole continuing medical education series on how to encourage families to look at that if there, you know, if there is need. And I just thought, I can't do that. You know, I see kids as young as, you know, newborns all the way up through 18, and how can I be a proponent of that? Another issue, which has always been a problem, has been the abortion referrals. They want to move the female care from OB-GYNs to primary care doctors. And recently they just, you know, had workshops on how do you perform gynecological exams and insert IUDs and how do you give birth control to kids as young as 12 and not have their parents in the loop about it. Another issue that has really been heartbreaking is the whole transgender issue. These kids are hurting, and a lot of them come from abuse, and they're really confused, and they need counseling. But we have been given a set of guidelines, standard of care, that says, no, you can't send them to a therapist, you know, to try and resolve that issue. You have to send them to a specialist in transgender issues who can help them with their gender dysphoria and help them transition. And it's so, you look at this and you just think, oh, Lord, you know, how can I help these kids when, you know, we're being hand-tied? And obviously, as Terry said, you know, there are ramifications financially, culturally, and spiritually to the culture. There's a lot of money being made in, you know, all of these medical marijuana, abortion, issues with the transgender, transitioning. It's a huge industry now. We would be threatening their financial status if we continued to promote abstinence and therapy instead of, you know, the automatic transitioning. Culturally, our culture doesn't want to hear anything Christian right now, and it's so hard. And then spiritually, obviously, we know that these kids are just in that balance where a little thing can knock them over, you know. But the world says, you know what, we don't want any of that. We don't want our kids being taught these things. So that's just some of the issues that I was dealing with.
Thank you. I just thought hers are so relevant because they're right today in her occupation. We could go on and on about a lot of this, but we definitely are living in a post-Christian era, and we need to learn, I want to say today, probably my main point is to articulate better our Christian viewpoint and why we believe it. And I don't have great answers. I want to learn myself, but there's lots of places we can go, can hear people speak on apologetics and things so that we can better explain what we believe. The world that Demetrius lived in was threatened by Christians because Paul was teaching the truth. And we want people in our world to be threatened in a good way by the truth of the gospel and by our testimony of good teaching and thinking. So I want to close with this verse that I've always loved from 1 Peter 3:15. It says, always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. But do this with gentleness and respect. And I think that would be a great thing to talk about in our groups today. So let's just close in prayer.